From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a rather provocative headline in the New York Times. It was an opinion piece written by a shellfish and seaweed farmer on Long Island Sound named Bren Smith. The piece was titled, "Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers." But why? Simple, Smith writes. It's a great way to go broke. Smith writes, quote, "The dirty secret of the food movement is that the much-celebrated small-scale farmer isn't making a living. After the tools are put away, we head out to second and third jobs to keep our farms afloat. 91% of all farm households rely on multiple sources of income, health care, paying for our kids' college, preparing for retirement, not happening, with the overwhelming majority of American farmers operating at a loss. The median farm income was negative $1,453 in 2012. Farmers can barely keep the chickens fed and the lights on." End quote. But the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, has called for 100,000 new farmers within the next several years, and Congress claims to support young farmers with loans and USDA support programs. Still, nearly two-thirds of American farmers are over the age of 55. So this hour, we wanted to bring together a panel of young farmers who have chosen their career here in Western New York. Why are they doing it? Can they sustain it? My guests for the hour, let me start with the old man of the group, is Dennis LaPelle, who is not often thought of as the oldest farmer at a ripe young 37.
Correct.
This is the only hour where you have to really reveal ages. Sorry, Dennis.
That's okay.
Dennis is the co-owner of Lakestone Family Farm in Farmington, and you, most of the time, you're the youngest farmer in your cohort, but not today.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about what drove you into this profession in a moment. The youngest man in the group is James Cagle. He's the owner of Buzz's Garden. That's a small and sustainable farm in Honey Eye Falls. And James, your ripe old age is?
23 years old.
23. And so you've chosen this career. Can't wait to talk about that. And Ben Eskind and Emma Brinkman are here. They're the owners of Pachamama Farm in Farmington. 28 years old and still happily at Pachamama. You're about to celebrate two full years. Is that right?
Yes, this will be our third season.
All right, so the third season for you guys, Lakestone in your fourth season.
Fourth season,
and James Buzz's Garden, you're now in your second season.
Correct.
All right, Dennis LaPelle, when did you make the move to farming, and why?
So we were living in New York City, and we had transitioned our family's eating habits into less processed food and more real food. And we were at a point where we could make a change in our lives. We had been caring for an elderly relative who passed away, and it gave us an opportunity to move back to Rochester, where my parents are from. And we kind of, on a lark, were saying, well, what if we started a farm? So we had been looking into it for a little while, just sort of playfully, and it seemed like it would be, you know, a doable thing. We were members of a CSA down in New York, and we would go on, you know, farm visit days, and we'd go out and visit the farm, and we'd walk the grounds, and it just looked like to me, boy, this is something I could really do. Now, I had no idea that, you know, the farm I was walking there was like, you know, 20 acres and organic vegetables. Now, to me, that would be virtually impossible to actually cultivate, because I just know how much work goes into it. So it gives me a lot of respect for what they're doing.
How many acres are you?
This season will be about 3 acres mm-hmm. in vegetables, two and a half to 3 acres.
Most people do not walk the grounds of a farm and think, yeah, I could do this. Actually, most people I know walk the grounds and think, this is amazing, and I'm glad I don't have to do it. You did not grow up on a farm.
No, I did not grow up on a farm. I grew up in the 19th Ward in Rochester. I was fortunate enough as a child to be able to spend my summers in the Finger Lakes. And so every weekend, Fridays after my father would get out from work, we'd load up our Chevy van and we'd go trucking down to Cayuga Lake. And we'd spend the weekend at a campsite on the lake. And then we would Sunday, you know, pack things up and go back to the city. And this went on, you know, until I was old enough to get a job myself. So I was driving by these farms all the time, seeing all these farms, and just kind of planted, I say that's where I kind of planted the seed, is, you know, thinking. It more came from the idea of me saying, boy, I don't have any useful skills. Maybe I could live off the land. Now, as a seven-year-old, you have no idea that that would actually mean you need quite a set of skills and some money.
Yeah.
You know, for access to land and to do the things that you want to do. But, you know, from the innocence point of view, I think that was like my first real interest in, you know, farming.
Did you drive past the farms and did you stop at those awesome roadside food and produce stands?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I mean, when we go down to the Finger Lakes, there are Mennonite stands everywhere. You know, you get something like 7,000 peaches for a nickel. I mean, it's right. I don't even know how they do it. It is so good. I'm always loving that. And so you probably grew up appreciating that.
Absolutely. Yeah, we used to shop at a farmer's market that was called Bodine's Farm Stand. It was on Route 89 in Seneca Falls, and we would stop there. And that's where we would, you know, that's where we got our corn all summer long. Mm-hmm. As we'd go. If we would, a few times, you know, when my dad had a week vacation, we'd stay there for the week, and we'd get corn and things like that. And you know, cherries and strawberries and blueberries and all the good stuff of summer.
So you saw it from childhood, but again, making the transition to a career is a very, very serious undertaking. You have a very smart and determined wife, who I've met. But to make that leap, what was it that put you over the top to say that we can do this? Take me through that process.
So I had a long, when my father-in-law was ill, I had a very long talk with a very dear old friend. And our conversation was about the average age of farmers in New York State. At that time, I believe it was 69, and that it wasn't getting any younger. And that there are a lot of opportunities with land being opened up, and not so much a situation like how I ended up where I actually purchased my land, but, you know, other situations where there's land trusts and things like that. So we were just talking about it, and, you know, I had shared with him that, you know, I really, when we went on our CSA farm visit, that I thought it was something that I could do, and he gave me a little bit of encouragement. And, you know, it was kind of like a sort of a, at that time it was the romance of it, you know, before the reality of what I was actually getting into, you know, kind of set in. So I had, I knew that it was a business, and I knew that there was a lot of things business-oriented that were important to know with getting into agriculture. I knew that I was decent with mechanics. I knew that I could do carpentry. And so I felt like I had some decent skills. I just needed to learn how to grow vegetables, and that then I would be okay. So I quit my full-time job and went to work at Stone Barns Center in Pocantico Hills in the Hudson Valley. And I learned organic agriculture, and I think one of the best places to learn it, at least on the East Coast. There's access to everything you could possibly want there. Any tool that I could never afford is there. So you could really get a sense of how to do everything and then draw from that the conclusions that I've come to how to farm our property.
What were the early ideas for your farm, and how did they change?
Well, right now, chicken is a pretty big part of what we do. Starting out, I didn't think I was going to do any chicken until I read You Can Farm by Joel Salatin. And that was a very inspiring book for someone who'd never done any commercial farming at all. And he was very, very much onto the idea of chicken. And so I read another one of his books called Pastured Poultry Profits. And then I realized that to make it in farming, I was going to have to make some money, and there's a pretty decent profit margin on livestock. And I feel like that was a good way for me to get a little more money, you know, early on. It's a pretty quick turnaround, 8 weeks, and then you can start making sales. So you don't need a lot of money up front to get to it, and then once you start processing, you can start making a little bit of money.
Had you killed a chicken before?
No. No, that was...
Do you remember the first time?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. I was volunteering at a different farm out in Long Island called Restoration Farm, and we were doing a run of 30 birds. It took us about 5 hours to get through 30 birds, and it was the first time I killed that whole season. I killed one chicken, and it was a very, very heavy experience for me. It was... I never could really stand the sight of blood beforehand. So that was one issue to get over, and the other issue was, you know, the fact that I was taking a life. But it was different for me because I knew that this chicken was going to be coming home with me. So I slaughtered the chicken and, you know, dressed it and brought it home, and then we cooked it and ate it the next day.
What's interesting is that on this program before, you have said that, contrary to the idea that, well, now that you do this regularly, and, you know, regularly is not every day, but
right.
Now that you do this, some people would think, well, there's a desensitization. And there inevitably is some. But you've said that it is still an experience that grounds you, that sort of slows you down, makes you think a little bit,
right.
Even when it happens now.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, James can attest to it. my first season, James started working with me, and he was with me the second half of my first season and all of my second season, and he was there in a processing shed with me, and so he knows, like, especially the first time, how it's a very emotional experience. Now, as the season goes on, as most people do with their work, you kind of make light of it a little bit, but there's still a strong emphasis on the reverence of what we're doing, that we are ending a life.
All right, so now you do chickens, and how many acres total again?
So, well, our total farm acreage is 65 acres, and we do our chickens on about 2 acres of pasture, and then we have about 2.5 acres of vegetables.
2.5 acres of vegetables. And biggest misconception you had when you thought, I'm going to be a farmer, to today is what?
I think it's the, for me, I would say it's the amount of personnel, like how much personnel it takes to get things done, and what that true cost of that is to the farm, especially not just the salary, but when it comes to insurances and taxes and things like that. My original plan didn't call for as much help as I need, so I was off my mark on that, and that ultimately has affected the amount of money I'm able to earn, because it's, you know, okay, I get what's left at the end. So,
well, we're going to interrogate. We're not going to ask for all of the financial details. I didn't call their accountants, but we'll get into more of that in a moment. Let me go around the table now and turn to Ben and Emma again, the owners of Pachamama Farm in Farmington. And your story is, you guys, well, you've known each other since, I think, growing up,
yeah,
haven't you?
It's a love story, really.
Okay.
Yeah. If you want to get right down to it.
Your wife just rolled her eyes at you.
No, seriously. Okay. I mean, you go back 10 years ago when we were 18, and falling in love, and one of the shared ideals we had was a concern for the environment. Something we connected over immediately, in addition to, you know, all sorts of other great ideas. And so one of the funny things is that I could probably say that how I got interested in farming is from my romantic side, my idealistic side. And I think that, you know, that's exactly what I would say should be what sends young people on their way towards a career in farming. And it gets to the heart of what Brent Smith is talking about. I mean, that we, you know, the reality is on the one hand very bleak, but that it doesn't mean, you know, what he's trying to point out is not just that there's bleakness, but that there's an issue here and that we have to get at it. And anyway, that's getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, but I think you're right. I think this notion of how do we get more young people into farming, I think there's a generation. You know, we talked about climate change last hour. We talked about issues that impact us in many different ways on this program. And I think you're right. I think that feeling of wanting to do something valuable probably logically will pull more people into farming.
Yeah, and you know, I'm kind of tired of reading people's, you know, there's a general characterization of our generation as selfish and at least quite different. And there's also this notion that apathy is plaguing our youth. And, you know, the more that we succumb to this idea that, you know, that something shouldn't be done simply because it's hard or simply because there's not a lot of money in it is not a good reason to not do it. You know, we need to be solving these problems. And one of the beautiful things about farming that should not be forgotten is that, unlike many other businesses, there is a very sizable moral and social value to what all of us in this room are doing. And, you know, people, we have to gather around and recognize that and appreciate it. Not that we don't. And I'm constantly impressed and optimistic because of the growing interest in what we're doing and the support and the continued growth. But we have to take it a step further. And my concern is when I read someone like George Packer in his new book, The Unwinding, says that the default force in America is organized money. That's scary because corporate money is so incredibly organized. And we see the havoc it's wreaking on education, on politics, and on agriculture. And, you know, as much as the movement that we represent right here is growing and increasing in numbers, you know, if you look at Occupy Wall Street, one of its biggest problems was, where's the organizing principle? What's the actual key? And I think we struggle with that in our business, in part because, you know, what Dennis is talking about is we're farming on an extremely small scale. You know, people still talk about small scale in agriculture being at 20,000 acres, where you're, you know, driving a GPS-powered tractor and cultivating to within 2 inches of accuracy. Now, the production efficiencies of those are incredible, but the flaw is that it's operating on a model that says corporate interests, standard business models are what we have to turn to be successful in feeding the world. And that's just simply not the right approach necessarily.
Well, can I only because Ben's taking me way off in a direction I wasn't even really ready for, but that's great. Can I ask you just briefly, and this is tangential, but can I ask you about feeding the world? When you read about population models, for example, if we see the world go to 10 to 12 billion, are you worried that small farm operations are not enough and we do need to be more large scale, more efficient? I'm not endorsing it. I'm asking you, is that part of the equation?
Yes, absolutely. Scale in agriculture is one of the most important problems that all people researching this subject are looking at. And one of the things that I was particularly interested in when I first, you know, set foot in, because I was kind of, I got into agriculture coming out of an academic context, out of a liberal arts school. And so I was meeting professors who were also interested in agriculture. And that's been a key question for a long time. And it's, but again, it gets back to the fact that it's both a, it's, you know, there's a public policy issue there and there's an economics issue. And it's this confluence of macro and microeconomics that makes this problem so complicated. But my personal feeling is, like on many things, that it's got to be well-rounded. No, I'm not going to sit here and advocate that we abolish all farms of a certain scale. But I am going to sit here and advocate that I believe that the quality from a product standpoint, from the reduced impact on the environment, from the increased potential for community building that farms like ours represent, and that's incredibly valuable, and we need to grow it a lot more than we are. So I think that, you know, but you look at what's being grown on the large scale, not the same kind of stuff that we're growing by a long shot. And people are, you know, if we want to be healthy, we have to keep farmers on the micro scale as around. And, you know, they're the CSA model and a guy, you know, bioregionalism was an early idea pioneered by an author named Jim Dodge, you know, a while back, is the precursors to the locavore philosophy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of what's continuing to evolve and what has to keep evolving.
All right. So, Emma, let me ask you then. He's talking, he's going back 10 years, but Pachamama Farm is only a few years old. When did you know that you were serious and you were going to create your own farm?
Yes, well, so I guess, I mean, our relationship developed 10 years ago, but at the end of college for us, which was 2008, 2009, both of us started working on farms in the Hudson Valley. And that was when sort of the tangible dream really manifested. So ever since that point, we've both been working on farms or tending our own gardens, basically growing food for ourselves. And that just became more and more of an enriching experience. Basically continued to sort of, like Dennis was saying, become this dream that was definitely a fantasy, but that sort of felt like it could become more of a reality. So then we were living in Rochester on the west side, in my grandmother's old house, tending a huge garden, growing food for ourselves for the whole year, and started just looking at land around the Rochester area, sort of on a whim, seeing whether or not this could become a reality for us. And we had only looked at 2 pieces of property when we found the property that we're on right now, which is 15 acres in Farmington, right down the road from Dennis. But we found the property, and it sort of was the perfect piece of land for this small-scale vegetable operation that we had been envisioning for the last 5 years. So so we basically took a crash course online, you know, taught ourselves about mortgages within a month, and decided that considering that at the point in which we purchased the farm that the mortgages were at an all-time low, we just decided that we were going to go for it. So even though we had been dreaming about it for a really long time, it kind of all the pieces fit together when we found the piece of property that we're on. Soils were perfect, had all the infrastructure that we needed, water and stuff. And so it was really this particular piece of land that allowed us to do what we're doing right now.
And we've got listeners of this program across the age spectrum. For those who are actually thinking, boy, that would be an amazing life to pursue, there's land available and it's decently affordable if they want to look into it?
I would say so, especially around the Rochester area. We were surprised that we found what we did. I mean, obviously you have to have some savings, which fortunately we had been saving for a number of years. That was the reason we could do what we did. But it seems as if just because of the land value, especially in certain suburbs to the west of Rochester, tend to be a little bit more reasonable than to the east, or rural areas to the west. I would say that it's doable, but it just depends. You know, you have to be extremely frugal in your lifestyle, you know, afterwards, mm-hmm. and kind of figure out how to make it work for yourselves. But I don't know if you guys have different opinions
about
that.
But you heard Dennis talk about not only the notion of getting land, but then hiring a staff. Dennis kind of shot too low, or at least the idea was maybe underestimated how much help you need, or what the impact is on a family. And what have you found? What was the one thing that you look back on and say, well, we were wrong about this, and I'm glad we know this now?
I think that both of us underestimated the amount of work that it was going to take. We had worked for other people before as farmers. Both of us have a pretty strong work ethic, and we were not blindsided thinking, oh, it's going to be a breeze by any stretch of the imagination. We knew it was going to be a lot of hard work. But I do remember my dad, who has owned a number of small businesses. He's a chef in the Rochester area. He said that, you know, owning your own business is a 24/7 operation. And he kind of warned me with that in a loving way. And I trusted him, and I think I knew what he meant, but not until we started our own business did I realize how much work it was going to be beyond working for someone else. Because when you're working for someone else, you have set hours. When you're working for yourselves and creating your own business, it's just really, it truly is all the time. So I think that there was that aspect, just all the different pieces that we didn't necessarily think about before we started the business, and then just the physical labor of it seems to be a lot more demanding when you're doing it for yourself rather than working for someone else.
Well, there was also the issue of we set up our business in a particular way. You know, getting back to the scale question, I don't know, this could be perceived as a mistake or it could have been smart. We consciously chose to be very small scale as a way to reduce our debt load to zero, practically. And from our past experience, and what I mean is in terms of that, if you're smart, if you work on farms, like particularly the farms we worked on, like Dennis and ourselves in the Hudson Valley, really great farms, you know, catering to the New York City market, that you can get this experience and you can learn. A lot of small guys can start up these businesses with very low capital investment up front. It's not the same thing as applying for a government grant in the excess of $1 million range so that you can afford a machine that's going to give you economies of scale that are mind-boggling in comparison to what we're doing. So on the one hand, you know, we're not losing money. And, you know, probably compared to someone like Wegmans, we're making a lot more on the dollar than they are. But when you're on such a small scale, the volume is so reduced that the ultimate return at the end of the year is going to be, it's an economic issue. And that was a conscious choice on our part, but we were, you know, going into it knowing that we were going to have off-farm income.
Sure, and we're going to talk about that in just a second, but let me just wrap up this initial part by asking, how big is Pachamama?
We grow, this coming season will be on 1.5 acres
of vegetables. 1.5 acres,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And just vegetables?
Mm-hmm.
and vegetables and herbs, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Vegetables and herbs. James Cagle is the youngest man in the group. And again, if you're just joining us, we're talking about should you let your kids grow up to be farmers? And the New York Times, Bren Smith is a shellfish and seaweed farmer who recently wrote a piece saying no, that it is too difficult, that it is, especially for small and sustainable, it's almost not sustainable. But James, you grew up where?
I grew up in North Carolina. Moved up here my junior year of high school and finished up in Fairport.
Any farming experience growing up?
None.
None. Okay. So when you were graduating high school at Fairport, did you think at that time farming?
I was starting to get my eyes set on it.
Interesting. Why is that?
I had when I first came up here, I was introduced to the public market and the local food economy, which was all very new to me. Growing up in the hills of North Carolina, it's more rural and not the city atmosphere that we had up here. And so that was very fascinating to me, and I hadn't yet discovered all the other markets and the CSAs and things of the sort. And I had always been interested in food. It wasn't until I started reading books such as Folks This Ain't Normal by Joel Salatin that had kind of opened up my eyes to the availability of small-scale farming as a career.
Okay, and now you are the owner of Buzz's Garden. You call it a small and sustainable farm in Honeyway Falls. What are you growing?
I'm growing a wide range of vegetables. Vegetables only, but over 150 varieties of vegetables.
What's the size of it now?
I'm working 3 acres. I started with 2 last year, and I added 1 towards the end of the season, which I will start off with cover cropping. So not all 3 acres are in use at one time. They're in rotation with cover crops.
And if you are successful, you will eventually grow to how big?
I would stay within the 5 to 10 acre range. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the most reasonable economies of scale with a small scale farm.
Okay. And for you, same kind of question that the other panelists have had to answer, which is when you look at starting out, have you learned anything even in the short time that has surprised you that you felt like you were not as prepared for as you thought you were?
Yeah, quite a bit. I think anybody that's going off their own venture would discover new things, even things that they had thought they knew. They might have to relearn or learn in a different way. Certain methods that I learned at Dennis's farm and Farmington, I sort of had to reshape to fit my farm and my soils, 2 completely different soils. Business, I did not come into this with much of a business background. So learning the taxes, the marketing, and things like that were very new.
Okay. And what to you now, a couple seasons in, is the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge is tapping into the market, I suppose.
Finding customers?
Yeah. A large part of my business is the CSA, and I'm focusing only on the Honeyway Falls, Mendon area, not offering alternate pickup locations. I do 3 other markets, so that's my sort of downtown venue or outlet for my farm.
So now you've got a view of the landscape. What I want to do is, Bill in Rochester, you're going to be first. I want to take a very short break. We're going to come back, get some of your phone calls in, and get some ideas on whether it's working and what they think about the article that was pretty blunt about the challenges that farms exactly like the ones you're learning about this hour are facing in this country. Should we let our kids grow up to be farmers? I think everyone at this table says yes. In fact, I think Ben's about to jump on the table and say, not only should we, your kids should be farmers.
And poets, too.
And poets. And I love it. There you go. There you go. So short break, your phone calls and more with this panel on letting our kids growing up to be farmers next on Connection. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The average age of a farmer, I don't know if the exact average age, but we do know that roughly two-thirds of farmers are still over the age of 55. So we're looking at young farmers this hour. Who's choosing the career and why, and is it sustainable? We know that the U.S. Department of Agriculture wants to recruit more people to this career, but they only are going to do it, at least many of them are going to do it, if they think they can survive it. And so James Cagle's here, the owner of Buzz's Garden in Honeyoy Falls, Dennis LaPelle from Lakestone Family Farm in Farmington, Ben Eskin and Emma Brinkman are here from Pachamama Farm in Farmington, and our first phone call is Bill in Rochester. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi. I was just interested in the panel's views on government subsidies in agriculture. Like, I believe, for instance, at one point, at least, farmers didn't have to pay minimum wage. They could pay a wage lower than that for their labor. Aren't there also government programs that pay farmers to keep their fields fallow?
Yes to all of that. You're not wrong about any of those issues. But we come from a different side of farming. So to address the wage situation, at my farm, I can speak for myself that we start all employees at $10 an hour. Our emphasis on sustainability isn't just sustainable agricultural practices, but sustainable humanitarian practices. So it's important for us to be answerable to our staff as well and do everything sustainable. And that's why in our situation, we don't use any volunteer labor on our farm, because there's no way to put an applied value to that to know what the farm is actually capable of doing if it has to pay for all of its labor.
Regarding the government subsidies too, I mean, what is more common when I think the general public thinks about government subsidies is subsidizing corn and soy, bushels of that being subsidized by the government. So from an organic standpoint, or as sustainable farmers ourselves, none of us receive money directly from the government subsidizing the crops that we grow. I do know about programs that do pay farmers very, very small amounts of subsidies, but to put certain cover crops into rotation. For example, I think that the caller mentioned allowing fields to go fallow. So there are very small subsidies for cover cropping and fallow production on fields, letting fields go fallow. Mm-hmm. But for us, it's not sustainable necessarily to do that as a source of income, because, I mean, like we mentioned, we only own 15 acres. So if we were going to be spending our valuable time applying for a grant or subsidy to get money to cover crop, we're talking about a few acres. And that's equivalent to, I think, at most, like $60 a year or something like that. So
yeah, the government's not that interested in us because we're so small. And it's a political question, subsidies. And I think I would argue, and a lot of people out there are aware of, how influenced this is and how entrenched a fight this is in Washington when you're talking about the billion-dollar lobbying industry that's coming out of Monsanto and everyone else that's helping direct these subsidies towards large-scale farms.
Well, Frank on Twitter wanted to know if the deck is stacked against people doing exactly what your panel is doing. Yes, Ben?
Definitely, yeah.
Any small business. The deck is, it's not just us in farming. If you try to rent any storefront here in downtown Rochester and get people through the door, it's the same sort of struggle for us as small business owners. We just have other variables.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So would it be fair to say that you guys would disagree with farmers being allowed to offer lower minimum wages and to be paid, for not farming?
Yes, definitely, because, vegetable pickers are serving a social, they're doing something that's incredibly socially valuable. So to, pay them less is doing a disservice to our community and to our society.
There's a current notion within our local food movement where people are now saying that farming is a public service. So they're kind of looking at it as, we are growing and providing food for people, and that's a public service. So there's a lot of smaller organizations like the National Young Farmers Coalition who are putting out T-shirts that say, farming is public service.
Bill, does that answer your question?
Yeah, Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for making the call. If you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. The article in the New York Times, the opinion piece by Bren Smith, a farmer on Long Island Sound, Don't Let Your Kids Grow Up to Be Farmers, says this, and I read it at the top of the show. Let me read it again, and then we're going to talk to our panel about this. He says, the dirty secret of the food movement is that the much-celebrated small-scale farmer isn't making a living. After the tools are put away, we head out to the second and third jobs to keep our farms afloat. Emma, are you working another job?
Yes, indeed. For the last 5 years, I've worked four nights at Good Luck Restaurant, which is basically what supports the farm. We make a very small profit, but to pay our mortgage and to pay our health care, the income I make at Good Luck is what's supporting that.
Is that formula going to have to exist in one way or another for your farm to continue to exist?
The way that we're proceeding on with our business, yes. And that is a personal decision. Maybe Dennis can speak to this next because he's raising a family and does not have an additional source of income. But for us, we, as Ben mentioned, decided that we don't want to grow our business indefinitely. There's a cap to the amount of acreage we'd like to grow on, and there's a cap to the amount of time we want to dedicate to the farm. So proceeding into the future, we have made the decision that I'm going to be the one, at least for the time being, that is the additional bread earner. I'm, as I mentioned to you earlier, Evan, planning on trying to become a teacher over the next few years. I'm considering going back to graduate school. So,
but again, that's part of your model, and you are happy with that, and you know the terms to it.
Yeah, yes, it's the decision that we're making that we think is best for the business. So, and not to mention that at least idealistically I'm choosing to be a teacher so that I will have summers off to continue working on the farm. So
yeah, and again, I would just add to that the model we're choosing is, you know, directly, you know, I mean, it's kind of Bren Smith is kind of addressing people like us when he made that statement.
Yeah.
And it's a model that can work at a certain level and is just, I would say, a part of the puzzle here. It's not that, you know, I wouldn't say you can't take what he's saying as categorically applicable in the entire industry, nor can we say that what we're doing is the panacea to our food shed issues.
One thing I do want to add, though, about the second job situation is that it is not sustainable. At least the life that I've been living for the last two seasons is extremely unsustainable, which is why we're reshaping the direction of the business, and which is why I'm trying to pursue an alternate career, is that what I have done for the last 2 years is work starting at about 7 a.m., work on the farm until 2 or 3 p.m., take a very quick break. If I have time, take a 5 to 10 minute power nap, and then go work nights from 4 until midnight or 1 o'clock at the restaurant. Wake up again and do it the next day. So that is definitely not an uncommon model. I mean, I know a number of other farmers who actually have chosen the restaurant business as a place to earn an income too. So it, even though I'm saying that our business is, we're choosing to have a dual income, I'm also choosing to get out of a line of work ultimately in the restaurant business that is unsustainable to pair with the farm. So in doing it this way, you know, you have to be smart because there certainly is a burnout that I have experienced.
Okay. So. Dennis LaPelle, any second jobs in your family?
Currently, no. Our youngest child is still at the age where he needs full-time attention from a parent. So while I'm outside working, my wife is inside taking care of the child. And then in addition to that, I have too much time invested into farming. As it is, so I'm overworking myself. I do force myself to take time off, but you know, keeping a busy market schedule and then keeping everything going at the farm, you know, is a lot. So Saturdays and Sundays I'm at market at Canandaigua Farmers Market and Brighton Farmers Market, and it's those 2 days are shot. So a lot of, like, you know, if I were to look to a restaurant type work, I wouldn't really be attractive to me because I'd have to be up so early in the morning. So that really is not something that would fit into my schedule. But my wife is now that our youngest is getting older, getting ready to get, you know, an off-farm job.
Okay. And going for, and by the way, when I say, do you or your wife have a second job? Raising three kids is
A job. Yeah. I was talking income.
I should say second income.
Right.
And will you or your wife have to have a second income for your farm to be able to continue?
I think at this point, I wouldn't say necessarily for it to continue, but if we want to improve our lifestyle, I think so. Because we're to the point now where the farm is able to pay our mortgage and all of our utilities, but it isn't fully capable of supporting us completely. We're five. I have three kids.
So the farm is not in the red.
No, the farm is in the red.
Okay, the farm is in the red. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm not. We're not able to completely support ourselves on the farm alone. We're still working on savings. But you know, our goal was when I initially set out, my plan was to build the farm over the first 3 years, which is where we're at. And this season is, hypothetically speaking, the season that I will finally make money. Everything that we've earned, I mean, we've been growing the farm.
Absolutely.
We've been reinvesting. And we've made a lot of strides that way. But as far as, you know, building my retirement, no. Okay. I haven't put a penny into it.
Gotcha. James Cagle from Buzz's Garden. Second job for you?
The past two winters I've had to hold a winter job to get me through the winter. However, through the season, I'm able to support myself through the farm income only. For me right now, it's not as difficult as, say, other farmers that own land or their own houses or have kids and a family. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I don't own my own house or land. So right now, the overhead is relatively low. I lease the land. It's doable for a 23-year-old, and it's worth the while doing if you don't like earning just $10 an hour at a job, and I think it's a decent alternative to going to college and getting a degree and facing the walk of shame of, you know, am I going to be able to find a job that's pertinent to my degree that, you know, I'm not overqualified.
That's not always shameful. I take the point, though.
Yeah.
I take the point that it is increasingly difficult to find jobs mm-hmm. pertinent to the career that you've studied in college and often accruing quite a lot of loan debt, for example.
Right.
So, yeah, I take the point. Speaking of some of our guests and where they've put their operations, Catherine in Greece has a question about that. Go ahead, Catherine.
Hi. The area of Victor Farmington is developing, you know, even as we speak, especially in Victor. And I have personally run into some issues when development starts around you or near you where the pro-development people don't, the issues of a farm are not exactly on their priority list, however. And I wondered what you would do if what we call the track pack shows up and tries to buy your land to put the McMansions up that are going up there, and the fact that even if you didn't want to sell, because I understand that some of these developers ring people's doorbells and actually pester people for their land if they have a lot of acreage. That's in Victor. But would you cash in and leave? And then even if you stayed, I understand that if you had a fancy house next to you on the next lot, that many of these developers make it very uncomfortable for you. And even though people want to live in the country, they don't want to smell the country. So I'd like to know whether, if you feel like you are there to stay, or do you think that you could be influenced by development around you?
Catherine, thanks for the call. I'll start with Dennis. What do you think?
Oh, I'm in it for the long haul. There's several things. Number one, our part of Farmington is zoned agricultural, and it's protected. So no new houses can go up on less than 5 acres of property in the part of Farmington where we live. Secondly, I bought a very undesirable piece of land for a developer. About between a third and a half of our property is DEC-protected wetland, and it's illegal to build on, and it's illegal to fill in. As a matter of fact, we got a call from the Army Corps of Engineers when we bought the property asking us what our intentions were for the land because it's wetland status. So that I think, for us is what, you know, addresses that situation. But I fully understand what you're talking about in Farmington, Victor, because there are properties like right on County Road 8 that were, you know, corn when I bought my place 5 years ago and are now You know, the roads are going in for the balloon McMansions.
Em and Ben?
I think it's a great question. It's a loaded question too, because you know, we're talking about money here, and one of the things that I would say is that whether people stay, go, how these decisions get made, do have a lot to do with communities, and how strong those communities are, the relationships that people have with each other, with their neighbors, and how we all commune and get together and talk about that. And one of the beautiful things about our business, and particularly the types of farms that we're operating here, are that we are a place and an area where those interactions are extremely rich, and there's a lot of possibility for developing community, you know, strong communities and relationships with your neighbors. And I think that, you know, that's, you know, the best kind of place to go about dealing with these very personal and complicated questions about people staying and moving out. And, you know, the other issue is, you know, demand. You know, when we were, you know, for the development in Victor, on the one hand, you know, if you're getting into farming, you have to be very smart about your location. It's not just location, location, location in terms of, you know, retail sales, but like Dennis is saying, you want to be in a place where you're fairly confident that you're going to be able to have your land and have it remain secured and uncompromised from an ecological standpoint as well. So there's a lot of factors to consider, to say the least.
A lot of great comments and questions coming in from Twitter. Patrick jumps in to say, in conversation, James talks often about the value of farmers helping each other out and their desire to do so. And sends a thumbs up for that. Daniel wanted to ask, are most of the guests crop farmers? What do they do out of season, not during planting, maintaining, and harvesting? And again, as you just heard James talk about, you spent part of your winters the last couple of years working another job to help supplement. But for you guys, off-season, I mean, Emma's always working, as we've established, and Ben, I assume you are as well. But during the cold months, what are you doing?
I probably should have gotten a job, but instead I sat in front of a fire and read books.
Oh, also, though,
no, I'm that's half kidding, but no, yeah, I mean, hey, there's a million things to do in the off season, and this winter was particularly brutal in terms of working outdoors, of which there's always things to do outdoors on a farm, including dealing with structural damage, and you know, Karen Miltner recently wrote a good piece in the DNC about the toll that this winter has taken, and the flip side to it, in regard to certain kind of pest issues that can be suppressed by extremely cold weather, and so on. But there are a million things to do on a farm, as most of us know.
So you've got lots to do. Here's Colleen mentioning some things that you might not think about if you want to start your own farm. You often entertain customers in different ways. She says, Emma and Ben host events such as dinners at the farm to showcase their chosen work and talent. And here's another one of your fan club. Marianna is on the line with us. Go ahead, Marianna.
Hello. Thank you so much, Evan. Love your program, and thanks for having my friends and this topic on. I work at Pachamama Farm. I'm a volunteer. I'm an educator and passionate about Mother Earth, Pachamama. And I feel that farming is in our DNA. It's in our cellular memory. My ancestors were farmers, and I can't live without growing something.
Well, I think you're getting a lot of nods around here. It just sounds to me, Ben, like that's exactly the way you feel, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a tradition that is ancient, and I think that it's something that we've all been attracted to, and it's particularly pertinent in an era where our future, in many respects, is marginalizing things that are genuinely human.
Dave wanted to know if any of you guys shop at supermarkets like Wegmans?
Every week.
Okay.
Every week. We shop at Wegmans for things like dried goods, shop at Abundance for nuts and beans and stuff like that. But Ben and I were joking lately that we should not be shopping anywhere because our freezer is still full of produce from last season, and we've only got, what, 2 months now to get through it before we start growing more. So we're pretty much committed to
host more parties.
Committed tonight. committed to not trying, you know, shopping as little as possible because we've got a lot of food to get through.
Okay, James.
I do shop through the winter at the supermarkets to supplement my diet. Through the season, though, I can find whatever I need at the markets themselves while I'm there, buying or trading with other farmers and vendors.
Okay, well, I think we've had a great hour talking about the piece, Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers. Dennis LaPelle, let your kids grow up to be farmers if what?
Oh, gosh. If you want them to learn a great way to support themselves, to be self-reliant, and to make a good, strong contribution to what at least our family believes in.
James?
If you believe in societal morals and values and want to create a stronger connection between that and the Mother Earth and the soil that we serve.
Ben?
If you're enthusiastic, inspired, interested, passionate, I think you should go about pursuing wherever those take you, wherever that takes you.
Emma?
I'm going to take a slightly more pessimistic outlet here, but if you are willing to live on less, because I think that all of us can attest to the fact that none of us are going to be rich. It's really hard to save for retirement, and that even though it's a wonderful way to earn a living, it's very hard to make the same as you would if we were working, you know, on Wall Street or in the business community.
I think if you go into it, at least with that, if you know that going in, you'll be less surprised or shocked about what happens, right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I hope you're all still doing the great work that you're doing in years to come. They've got CSAs, Pachamama
Absolutely.
Farms online. Where do you find it?
At PachamamaFarmNY.com.
PachamamaFarmNY.com. James?
BuzzesGarden.com.
Lakestone, Dennis?
LakestoneFamilyFarm.com.
Let's keep talking about farming issues and agriculture. Thanks for all the great questions and comments these hours. Val, great job. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on member-supported public radio.